I want to express appreciation for all of those that have shown hospitality and are continuing to do so. We've enjoyed some good company around family dinner tables and at restaurants and various places. We've certainly been privileged with this opportunity of being able to be with you in this endeavor. Very often there's as much learning and teaching and instruction going on with one another around a dinner table during gospel meetings as there is from the actual pulpit. And we appreciate that opportunity for this endeavor this week. As was announced, we are looking at the subject of Islam. And sometimes they talk about radicalized Islam. And really, as one American Muslim imam made the statement, he said there is no such thing as radicalized Islam. There's Islam and there's non-Islam. There's Islam and then there's those who aren't doing what Islam teaches. And in this lesson, I want us to keep in mind that even though we're going to be talking about what the Quran actually teaches, this doesn't mean that we need to be fearful of or be, as some of those who are more politically correct accuse, of being prejudiced against someone of a Muslim background. Because the fact of the matter is, 90% of those will be good neighbors, they will be good employees, employers. With the majority of them, you will not have a moment's problem. But then we look at those and we say, well, why is it if the Quran, and if you're telling the truth tonight, that the Quran actually does teach these things, then why is it all Muslims aren't believing these things? Why is it all Muslims aren't blowing themselves up? Why is it all Muslims are not endorsing jihad? Well, for the same reason that you can look in so-called Christendom throughout the world and ask the question, well, why is it the majority of so-called Christendom does not believe in baptism for the remission of sins? Why is it the majority of denominations practice instrumental music? You see, it's the same thing. That because it's in the Quran, you have those who are of a more liberal mindset among them also who say, well, these passages are just spiritual in nature. Even as you do when people try to make arguments on behalf of justification of sprinkling, for example, instead of immersion. Or you would have those who are unaware that these things are in the Quran. And that's why when you'll watch on TV and here will be an individual who has killed themselves in jihad, and they'll interview his parents or his imam, or they'll interview somebody who knew him and say, well, we don't understand it. He was here worshiping in the mosque with us and never had a moment's issue. And then all of a sudden the next day he goes out and blows himself up. We don't know what happened. Well, if we can relate that into the Lord's church, let's say that here is a Christian that we have begun notice hasn't laid by in store, for example. And we understand things happen. We forget our pocketbook. We forget our checkbook. For whatever reason. We didn't this week. But then we notice that over a period of months that they never laid by in store. And not because we want more money as the church, but because we're concerned about their fulfilling their duty to God and worship of obeying 1 Corinthians 16:1-2, we go to them and just say, brother, we it's been noticed that you're not giving of your means and just concerned about you for that. And you point out 1 Corinthians 16:1-2 to him, and he looks at it and says, you know, you're right. I didn't realize that was in there. I'll start doing that next week. Because the fact he was already a member of the Lord's church, there were some things we understood in common. We had a common framework, common foundation. Because he had already accepted the Bible as being authoritative, all it took was to show a passage to him. And then he was either going to say, no, it doesn't mean that, or yes, it does, and I'm going to do it. And so to those who are Muslim, and someone shows them because they believe in the inspiration and authority of the Quran, And somebody shows them, okay, you say you're a Muslim. Well, here's a passage that says that you're to kill Christians and Jews by Allah's permission. And he looks at it and says, so it does. And I think I will so I can get my 72 virgins. And that's why it seems like it's so quickly that they can change on that. They haven't changed. They had accepted already the Quran as being authoritative. What it took was someone who was a true Muslim, a true follower of the Quran, to show that to them and to instruct them more perfectly in the way of Islam. With that understanding, then, we would look at incidents such as September the 11th, and we would wonder how something like that could possibly happen. And the answer to that is quite simple. What caused it was simply this. Fundamental Islam caused it. Fundamental means a basic form of something. It's not the radicalized. This is the basic form of it. When you look in mainstream Protestantism, they are not fundamentalists. Mainstream Protestantism rejects the complete authority, complete inspiration of the Scripture. But those who are more conservative, who we may not agree, for example, with the more conservative end of the Baptists, but they do at least accept the inspiration, the verbal plenary inspiration of the Scripture. And so we would look at them, and some would look at us and say, well, those are fundamentalists, meaning we accept fundamental concepts of the Bible and Christianity. And so since people look at us and say, well, you're a fundamentalist, those who do this are fundamentalists also. That is, this is Islam in its basic form, what you saw on 9/11. The question becomes, well, what is Islam? And it is slightly different than the term Muslim. We use it sometimes interchangeably. Muslim refers to the individual. Sometimes you'll see the word Muslim. Some of the old history books use the term Mohammedans. But Islam is talking about the whole package. It's talking about the religion itself. We might say, for example, we are members of Churches of Christ, but as individuals we're Christians. As individuals they are Muslims, but the whole package is Islam. And the whole package also includes the practice of Sharia law. That is, the laws that if you go in public without a covering on, unveiled, then you're to be stoned. That is the type of law that we mean when we talk about Sharia or Sharia law. And that is the whole package form of Islam. It's a theocratic religion. So when you look at Islam, somebody says, well, don't you know that the Constitution grants freedom of religion, because if they can't have freedom to worship their way, then we can't have freedom to worship our way. And I understand that. And I'm basically in agreement with that on a conceptual basis. But when the Baptists decide that the Baptist Church needs to take over the world and kill all non-Baptists, then I'll oppose the Baptists too. The difference is, this is not just a religion, it is a governmental, political, legal systems type of perspective that the individuals have, rather than it just being a difference in religion. That's what Islam is in a nutshell. Their symbol, you'll see this on the flag of many different of the Islamic nations, is the crescent moon, and it depicts the moon in the increase stage, that it's getting bigger, that Islam started out small, but it's going to keep growing. It's on the increase, and it represents that growth of Islam, the faith from being small to great. The term Islam actually means submission. You might remember shortly after 9/11, individual after spokesperson were on TV trying to tell us, Islam is a religion of peace. Even our president at the time stating that. Some went as far as to say, don't you know that the word Islam actually means peace? That it comes from the word Salem. No. Jerusalem, Hebrew, certainly does mean city of peace. But this is a different word. This is Islam, not Salim. It's an Arabic word meaning submission. Submission to Allah, submission to His will. In fact, Muhammad's motto as he went from one tribe to another, forcing his religion upon them, the motto was, Allah, tribute or the sword. Muhammad is their prophet, the last, final, and great prophet to the vast majority of the Muslims. There are different Muslim sects, however, that would accept some other prophets after him. But to the vast majority of the 1.5 billion Muslims throughout the world, Muhammad is the last great and final prophet, and that his teachings are found in the Quran. We might also point out that the Quran is not all the teachings of the Muslims that they accept. There's also a series of writings less known that's referred to as the Hadiths. And these are the oral teachings or oral sayings of Muhammad. They're not given equal weight with the Quran, but it is where the vast majority of the Sharia law comes from. And it's where such teachings as the 72 virgins come from. So these are put together oral teachings that Muhammad and others from that time period, other of the Imams that were thought to be lesser inspired, also have their statements within. As we're thinking about the idea of what is Islam, it became not just a religion, but a social political system, as we've already touched on. When Muhammad first began teaching, Muhammad was born in 570 AD. Every once in a while I've heard individuals who are ignorant of their history say, well, you know, Islam predates Christianity. No, over 500 years after the establishment of the church, Muhammad is born. 570 AD, Muhammad is born, and he's born in Mecca. And, well, in Mecca, he was concerned about the extreme paganism that he saw around about him. He had married his older cousin. He is 25, she is 40. He marries his older wealthy cousin. And he becomes a caravan trader as she owns some caravans. And as he is on these caravan routes, he listens to so-called Christians, probably Catholics coming through, and he listens to Jews, and he weaves together what we find in the Quran. And you can realize as you go through the Quran that much of that must have been from memory and from misremembering, because there are various events that are wrong places within the Quran and biblical accounts that have people who were not even contemporaries living at the same time. And so as he finally began to oppose paganism in his hometown of Mecca, well, they oppose him and he flees to Medina. While in Medina, he strengthens his armies, he strengthens his beliefs, and he comes back to Mecca and forces them into submission to his teachings. And from there, it became a social and political system, along with a religious system as well. Spread by force of arms. Many will tell you, well, so did Christianity in its infancy. That maybe we're still looking at Islam in its infancy. Well, that's a pretty old infant, isn't it? With Islam being fully entrenched by about 600 AD, and they're still saying it's in its infancy. And historians will argue about the Crusades, but I challenge you to go home and look up the Muslim Crusades, which had begun hundreds of years before the Catholic Crusades. But let's say that is true. Let's go ahead and give them that bump. We're not talking about New Testament Christianity, are we? We're talking about what Roman Catholicism did, which was also a governmental religion, which also believed in a theocracy, which also had greed as a goal, along with theirs as well, of capturing land, of capturing treasures, and bringing those back to the coffers of Rome. So while some might look at that and say, well, Christianity has been just as bad. No, Catholicism has. Not New Testament Christianity. Find the pages of the New Testament where it's taught. Some will say, well, it is in the Old Testament. Well, that may be so. And it was only given to the Jews, the passages of wiping out the various Canaanite tribes, was only given to the Jews in the land of Israel as they went in to take the land. But where do we read that in the pages of the New Testament? Where is the Lord's church commanded to go and to take land by force and to convert men by force? You can't convert by force. You might have submission outwardly, but all one has to do is look at Native Americans and see what happens when you force someone to supposedly become a Christian. When the Spaniards came to the New World at the point of a sword, they forced Native Americans throughout the Southwest to be sprinkled. And all they got was wet, angry Indians in the process. They didn't convert the hearts. And as a result, when you go to the different Pueblo tribes that dot I-40 throughout New Mexico, you'll find unusual religions and holy days. That's a mixture of Catholicism and Native American religions. See, they never changed the hearts. And this is all that Islam is concerned about, is the outward. It's more of a outward religion rather than that which is involved in a change of the heart of man. Eventually, this formed into what became known as the Ottoman Empire that it took World War I to finally break the neck of. The Ottoman Empire is exactly what many are seeking to reestablish today. They refer to it as the Ummah, and stretching from Spain to the borders of India. And this is what they're trying to recapture. Now, following World War I, and unfortunately, the world was not done a great service by what was done after World War I. In the Balfour Agreement, the different lands throughout the Middle East, where it had been just sheikdoms and tribes, were broken up sometimes arbitrarily by the nations that won, by the Axis powers, and said, okay, because of their aiding of Germany in World War I, they said, okay, you're going to get this land, you're going to get this land, you're going to get this land, regardless of the fact that maybe some of these tribes were feuding tribes and some of these tribes were family tribes, and yet now they are divided by borders that were created for them. But they were kept so busy between having the back broken of the empire that for decades, Islam was not something that usually you and I were concerned with. We've only in recent years learned how to pronounce Sheikh, haven't we? Remember that so many songs and movies we used to hear the term Sheikh used. And then we find out after 9/11 it was Sheikh. So it took something like what Israel experiences daily to happen one time for us to begin understanding what is going on within the Muslim world. This formed the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was broke after World War I. All leases were given to the British Empire. Money was sucked out of the Middle East. Those leases began expiring. The Islamic world in the 70s began getting their money back. There is a principle in Islam that anybody, any organization, any company that makes money is to take a percentage of that money and send it to Muslim benevolent organizations. And you've heard of many, even here in the Metroplex, of these Muslim benevolent organizations that were found actually be supporting jihadist activities in the Middle East. And so now this money that has been coming in from royalty, from these wells, again began growing up jihadist activities, because now there's a funding that's available that hadn't been there for some time as these well leases began to expire. The Ottoman Empire then is a desire and a goal of reestablishment today. Islam is composed of two primary sects. I say primary because there are subsects under these, then there's other smaller sects too. But the main ones you're going to hear about in the news are the Shiites and the Sunnites, or the Shias and the Sunnis. The Sunnis form the majority. The Shiites are the ones primarily in the Persian countries, Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, and Iran. Until the secular dictators were taken out of the Middle East, they held at bay the Shiites. And we're not even saying whether they should or should not have been taken out of the way, but such ones as Saddam Hussein and Libya just recently, these were the secularist ones who kept at bay the power of the Shias. This has upset a political balance that's long been there. And now the Shiites are on the upswing, and they are sponsoring the Arab Spring that we're reading about throughout the news. The main difference between the Shias and the Sunnis, however, is a different belief in who led Islam after the death of Muhammad. Who led them? And so the Shias have a belief that the 12th Imam, the Mahdi, is going to come back to power, and he's going to purge the world of all non-Muslims, and the entire world is going to be restored under a caliphate with a caliph ruling the world. And so Iran has, as a result of that view, has, even though you have always referred to him as Ahmadinejad, as the ruler of Iran, that in reality it's the Ayatollah who is the political force and political power there. But there's other groups under these, such as the you would have the dervishes. You've heard the expression, the whirling dervishes. The dervishes, well, you might say, are the Pentecostal Muslims. They are the ones who believe in whirling themselves into a frenzy until they themselves get a revelation from God. And again, you would have some other groups. One group, though, that is of great concern are the Wahhabis. The Wahhabis are a sect of the Sunnis. In the 1700s, a Muslim by the name of Al-Wahhab lived. Up to the 1700s, for a couple of hundred years, Muslims had spread throughout Europe, had intermarried with non-Muslims. Their Muslim views began to be watered down and greatly weakened. Al-Wahhab said, "We need to restore Islam. We need to speak where the Quran speaks and be silent where the Quran is silent." They had a restoration movement in the 1700s. The Wahhabis are the Church of Christ of Islam. They are the most basic fundamentalist form of Islam, and all 19 hijackers on 9/11 were Wahhabis from Saudi Arabia, where their headquarters and basic seat of power actually is. The Wahhabis are the ones that would be most like us from the standpoint of saying, we want to go back to the book, and we want to do everything that it says and leave out the things that it doesn't say. It is one of the world's fastest growing religions, depending on what survey that you read, and no doubt it's greatly skewed, because some will have it saying it is the fastest growing religion in the world, or even the largest religion in the world. But what you have to remember is that if you are born in an Islamic country, you are automatically a Muslim. If you're born here, you're nothing religiously, just by being virtue of the fact of being born here. You make that decision and choice. But within Islam, if you're born in an Islamic nation, you are a Muslim. And so they're able to add that figure into the batch as they're adding this together. Comprise 1/5 of the world's population and continues growing. Muhammad, as we've already commented, was born in 570, died 632 AD, was a successful businessman, married his wealthy widow, self-proclaimed philosopher. He retreated to Nur during the month of Ramadan. It's important to notice this. You hear about the Muslims practicing Ramadan today. And when he was opposed in Mecca and fled back to Medina and to the community of Mount Nur, it was during the time, the month of Ramadan. You see, Ramadan was already in existence when Muhammad was observing this. When he fled, it was during a pagan holy day, something they were already engaged in. Islam has taken radical paganism and formed it into a more mainstream religion, but it was something that predated Muhammad. And Ramadan is one example of that. It was during that time that supposedly Gabriel visited him. He even wondered if he was insane, because he said that Gabriel visited him 3 times. And he goes back to his cousin Khadijah, his cousin slash wife, and they were not from Arkansas, and asked the question saying, am I crazy? And she said, go back one more time, ask him a series of questions and find out what the answer is. Come back to me. And she came to the conclusion, no, you're not crazy. You're a prophet. And she accepted him as being a prophet. And finally became an activist in his religion in Mecca. And ended up being the founder of Islam. Here is, you'll see on the news quite often as the Muslims are called upon for their different pilgrimages. They're called upon to go to in Ramadan. Once in their life, they're required to make this journey to the Kaaba at the great mosque in Mecca. And this is one of the things that the Muslims are so angry with the United States about, is that we have the base in Saudi Arabia, Air Force Base, that we used during the first Gulf War, and the more fundamentalist Muslims are saying there should be no infidels in the holy lands of Saudi Arabia. Here is the Kaaba, which this also predates Muhammad. This was actually a house that contained, and people would actually gather and worship there before Muhammad, and would worship multiple idols. Guess what the chief idol was named? It was the horned moon god, whose name was Allah. Now today that term Allah is indeed used in Arabic Bibles to simply mean God. But that's not where the word came from. It was the horned moon god of the pagans. And Muhammad instructed them, you need to get rid of all these idols and keep the one main one, who was Allah. Within this box that they position themselves around is a large stone that supposedly fell from heaven, maybe a meteorite, that they say was white when it fell down to Adam and Eve. When they sinned, it turned black, and within the Kaaba is a black stone. In the city of Medina, which is Muhammad's city and base of operation against non-Muslims from 622 to 632, this also is one of the holy cities that no non-Muslim may enter into either. And this tells us some things about it, about how physical the religion is, because it's contrary to the Bible, since Islam recognizes specific holy spots. Whereas the scriptures would tell us in John chapter 4, verses 20 and 21, as Jesus speaks to the woman at the well, she asked Jesus a question because she, being a Samaritan, the Samaritans had gone through the Old Testament and had changed the locations of different events in the Old Testament and the Samaritan Pentateuch. And they had them all as being in Samaria instead of Jerusalem. And so the woman at the well asked Jesus the question, our fathers worshiped in this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is Jerusalem. Now, Jesus didn't correct her by saying, no, it's Jerusalem is the place you ought to worship, which was certainly true. But that was going to be going away just a very short time anyway. So he gives her the final answer, which is John 4:21. Jesus declared, believe me, woman, the time is coming when you'll worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. So that the location is not important. It's where God's people meet. It's where the Lord's church assembles. There are five pillars of Islam. They do not have a concept of a plan of salvation. It is totally a system of works, a life of works. But there are five pillars. The Shahada is the profession of faith. It's a recitation. We might refer to it, it were amongst mainstream Christendom, as being the sinner's prayer, which says there's no God but God and Muhammad is the messenger of God. There's the Salat, the formal prayers, must be performed at 5 points in the day when facing toward the holy city of Mecca. We talked about this point three earlier of how individuals and businesses owned by Muslims are required to give an amount back to different Muslim charity organizations. It's called the zakat. Almsgiving through the payment of zakat, purification, is the duty of sharing one's wealth out of gratitude for God. Four, there's the duty to fast during the month of Ramadan. Now, when we think of fasting, usually think of going without food for a longer period of time. Among the Muslims, however, fasting is done from sunup to sundown, but they have a feast and party all night long. 5. Making the Hajj, or the pilgrimage to Mecca, is to be performed, if at all possible, at least once during one's lifetime. They're against the Bible in this respect, that in the Old Testament, we read about the child of promise, the seed of promise coming through Isaac. In the Quran, the emphasis is placed upon Ishmael. And they say he is the true one that the foundation of God's people was to come through. That it was he who raised the foundations of God's house. It's he who purified God's house of devotion and prayer. That he was one of the patriarchs. That he was the exalted one with Elijah, Jonah, and Lot. And that he was a messenger and prophet. What's the ultimate goal of Islam? It's the abrogation of Judaism and Christianity altogether. Remembering again that their concept is there's no God but Allah. And there's now, I don't know if you've seen it in the news, there are groups and individuals with stampers that's taking dollars. And on the back where it says, "In God we trust," they're stamping over God with a little stamp that says Allah. That was going around Facebook. Somebody was saying, if you get these, hand it back, saying, "I want a non-defaced one, please." But that's the goal. The Holy Quran was allegedly revealed to Muhammad by Angel Gabriel over a period of 23 years. While on the one hand, that the Muslims will tell you that Muhammad himself wrote it, Muhammad himself says that he was illiterate and that the Quran was not compiled until after his death. There is a significance to the Quran being in Arabic, though. You and I read Bibles in English, even though it was written in Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek. Most of us don't read those. We read it in the language that we speak. Even though there are Qurans in English and other languages, the Muslim will only accept as authoritative the Quran in Arabic. And it's the duty of a Muslim to memorize and to recite the Quran in Arabic. The problem is, the majority of the world does not speak Arabic. Even the biggest percentage of the Muslim world does not, because Indonesia is the largest Muslim country in the world, and they do not speak Arabic. So what do? You could probably take, you've seen now when you get the instructions with any kind of product, say a microwave, and it's this thick, but there's only one page in English, and there's a page in French, and every other language you can think of. As long as it's your own vocabulary, I mean your own alphabet, you could probably read it, at least pronounce it, probably butchering it, but you could probably pronounce it, and still not have a clue what it means. Or if it is a foreign alphabet, maybe it's, you see it that, here's one page in Arabic, a page in Chinese, a page in Japanese. And you might be able to learn that alphabet enough again to be able to pronounce those words and not know what it means. That's what the majority of Muslims do with the Quran. They recite it in Arabic with the assumption that they know what it means, and they do not. This is again why the majority of them do not understand that the Quran actually teaches jihad. Because even though they have memorized the Quran, they accept the actual words as holy. Now, I know we think of the Bible as being, quote, our holy book. It is, but you're not going to go on the rampage and burn buildings, are you, if somebody goes out here and defaces a Bible? I'd say, that's a shame. But they look at the actual words themselves as being holy, as being magical. In the Quran, chapter 12, verse 22, it says, "Surely we have revealed it in Arabic Quran, that you may understand. Thus we have revealed it a true judgment in Arabic. And if you follow their low desires after what has come to you in knowledge, you shall not have Allah any guardian or protector. And thus we have sent it down an Arabic Quran, and have distinctly set forth therein the threats that they may guard against evil, they may produce a reminder for them. 39:28, an Arabic Quran without any crookedness. Our point in all this is, and there's other passages, is that they accept only as authoritative an Arabic Quran. So that when you go to point out to them, the Quran teaches this and that, nope, you're an infidel. You're a kuffar, so we're not going to accept what you have to say because you can't read Arabic. And you're not a Muslim, so automatically we're not going to accept what you have to say about the Quran. Almost like what we said about the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Bible last night. That if you're not a Jehovah's Witness, they automatically do not accept what you will have to say about the Bible. The Quran versus the integrity of the Bible, there is a concept of repudiation in the Quran. That if one verse says one thing and another verse says this, it's not a contradiction. This supersedes this. Now, of course, we have an Old and New Testament. But the Old Testament did not contradict itself. The New Testament does not contradict itself. But the New Testament set aside the old law. Within the Quran, it all depends on what point in the life of Muhammad you look at. If you look within the Quran, you'll see at one point that he's actually praising Christians and Jews when he was fighting the pagans. Once he got the pagans subdued, then he fought against the Christians and Jews. So when they look at passage and say, see, here he speaks positively about Christians, calling them the people of the book, saying they're the most like us, to make friends with them. But you have to find later that when he did subdue the pagans, then he turned against them as well. The problem is the Quran is not written in chronological order. It's not even as most of our Bibles are. Our Bibles are usually set up by theme. Now you have history, poetry, prophecy, so on. The Quran, they simply took the longest chapters and put to the front, and the shortest chapters put to the back. The only way you can know at what point this was in the life of Muhammad is to look historically as to where he was at this point in life and match that up to where it was it says in that chapter he was. So that in chapter 2 of the Quran, verse 106, none of our revelations do we abrogate or cause to be forgotten, but we substitute something better or similar. Knowest thou not that God hath power over all things? So there is this replacement all the way throughout. You look at one chapter, you can't assume that that was the final word or the final saying on it until you read all the way through. It becomes very confusing. However, there's no contradictions allowed within Scripture. Passage we pointed to last night, John chapter 10 and verse 35, the Savior said, the Scripture cannot be broken. But the Quran is over and over. Some point to this and say, well, the Quran says in Surah, that chapter 2, verse 256, let there be no compulsion in religion. Truth stands out clear from error. Whoever rejects evil and believes, Allah hath grasped the most trustworthy handhold that never breaks. Allah heareth and knoweth all things. Let there be no compulsion. Well, that was true at one point. And when people try to tell you, well, Islam's a religion of peace, they're not going to force a religion. They'll turn to this passage. But they don't look all the way through. For here, within that very same surah chapter, it says, verily, those who believe and those who are Jews and Christians and Sabians, whoever believes in Allah in the last day and does righteous good deeds shall have their reward of the Lord. On them should be no fear, nor shall they grieve. And the non-traditionals, that is the non-fundamentalists, we use these passages like this to say, see, we are a religion of peace. Failing to realize that the traditional Muslim commentators and imams will all say, but those have been abrogated. Those passages have been superseded by another, such as the Quran, Surah 3. Whoever seeks a religion other than Islam, it will never be accepted of him. And in the hereafter, he'll be one of the losers. Whatever message we abrogate or cause to be forgotten, we bring one better than that or like thereof. Knowest thou not, Allah has the power to do all he wills. It's been replaced by this one. And so Islam has become a sponsor of terror as a result of it. Thus, and we quote the hadith on this, paradise is to be found under the shades of the sword. Islam does teach jihad. There are 111 jihadist passages in the Quran. 111. In part because the Arabian Peninsula was not to be occupied by certain peoples. The Quran says idolaters are filth, so they must not approach the area of Mecca. The Quran says war is necessary for moral cleansing. And if God did not prevent mankind, some with others, the earth would be full of corruption. If God did not prevent people, some with some and others, who truly the cloisters and churches and synagogues and mosques, and which is oft brought to the mind of the name of God, would have been destroyed. Some of the scholars attempt to look at this as being a spiritual battle, saying, fight against them by means of it, and have a great fight. They say, see, that just means fight against non-Muslims by using the Quran. And we are returning from lesser jihad to the greater jihad. But such verses, however, as paradise under the shades of the sword. When Muhammad said, know that paradise under the shades of the sword and being killed in the road of God covers all sins. That doesn't sound like a spiritual battle, does it? And this religion will ever be established even to the day of the resurrection as long as Muslims fight for it. God is sponsor for him who goes forth to fight on the road of God. If he be not killed, that doesn't sound just like a spiritual battle, that we're having a study of a Bible and a Quran side by side, but a physical fight, he shall return to his house with rewards and booty. But if he shall be slain, he shall be taken to paradise. The fire of hell shall not touch the legs of him who shall be covered with the dust of battle on the road of God. The reward for martyrdom, according to the Quran, chapter 9, those who believe and suffer exile and strive with might and main in God's cause with their goods and their persons have the highest rank in the sight of God. When you meet unbelievers to fight, smite their necks. At length, when you thoroughly subdue them, bind a bond firmly on them. Thereafter is the time for either generosity or ransom until war lays down its burdens. That's not just a spiritual battle, is it? Instead, the Quran teaches there are three options for non-Muslims. You can either convert to Islam, pay the protection tax, and agree not to oppose Islam. And this is a punitory tax that continues increasing. It's not a 999. It then becomes a 10-10-10 and 11-11-11 until finally somebody says, I can't pay anymore. Okay, then convert. That's your only option. And if finally you do not pay that, you die. That's the three options which the Quran allows. The Quran teaches on religious mortal combat. Fight in the way of Allah against those who fight against you, but do not transgress. Surely Allah loves not the transgressors. Slay these transgressors wherever you meet them and drive them out from where they have driven you out. For persecution is worse than slaying. If they desist, then surely Allah is most forgiving and merciful. And then finally, notice in red, fight them until there is no persecution and religion is professed only for Allah. That's the goal. The Quran allows you to be offered an invitation to join Islam three times. And you reject the invitation three times, the alternative is death. That's not defensive battle only. The ultimate goal of Islam, again from the Quran, surely the true religion with Allah is Islam. Whoso seeks a religion other than Islam, it shall not be accepted of him. Fight them until there's no persecution. Religion is professed only for Islam. Let them fight in the cause of Allah, who would sell the present life for the hereafter. Fight in the cause of Allah and for the rescue of the weak men, women, and children. Those who believe, fight in the cause of Allah. And again, there's 111 such passages throughout the Quran. One of the Muslim organizations, the United States, offered a book entitled, We Believe in Jesus, trying to convince everybody, you know, you Christians are trying to act like we don't believe. Of course we believe in Jesus. Why, we're almost like you. You know, you have Baptists and Methodists and mainstream Protestantism all accepts one another. Why can't you just accept us? We believe in Jesus too. But within this book, they write, Allah negates from himself the possibility of his having any son or associating his dominion in his acting and decreeing and in the worship of him. But they're opposed to the concept of worship, adoration of Jesus. That God cannot have a son. That, according to the Quran, women are sinful. Women are innately evil. Women were put here as a punishment for man. Quite a bit of difference from reading Genesis chapter 2, isn't it? They were helpmeets for one another. But within the Quran, women were put here by the devil in order to tempt us and torment us and to test us. Is it any wonder the low treatment and degradation of womanhood throughout the Muslim world? Why isn't the women's organization speaking out against that? Why is it you don't hear more of the women's rights movements pointing to Islam and condemning that instead of a few years ago when the Southern Baptist Convention had a decree saying Christian women are to submit to their husbands, and boy, that was written up in newspapers throughout the country. But because there are low respect for women, they said, you know, Jesus could not be God because he was born of a woman. And women are evil, so anything coming from a woman must be evil. So Jesus could not be God. So God cannot possibly have a son. In fact, the Quran itself says in chapter 23, Allah has not taken on a son, nor is there any deity along with him. If this were so, each deity would take away that which he created, and one would have overpowered the other. Exalted is Allah, and free of that which they attribute to him. Knower of the unseen and of the apparent, and high is he that is above, they associate with him. Allah has not taken a son. So, the Quran is against the Godhead then also. The Quran says in chapter 4, O people of the book, Christians and Jews, exceed not the limits of your religion. Say not of Allah anything but truth. Verily the Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, was only a messenger of Allah and a fulfillment of his word which he sent down to Mary in mercy from him. So believe in Allah and his messengers and say not they are three. Desist will be better for you. Now last night we talked about the Godhead, the Trinity, the three in one. However, the Quran says, say not there are three. Now what that also shows us is that the concept of the Trinity is that old. That it's not something new. Because here this is written around 600 AD, and obviously the concept of Trinity was well entrenched and is the cornerstone of Christendom at that time. For the Quran to say not there are three. Well, the Bible, as we showed last night, presents the idea there being three within the Godhead. We point to 1 John chapter 5, verse 7. The Father, Son, the Holy Spirit, these three are one. Indeed, they are disbelievers who say Allah, he is the Messiah, the Son of Mary. They say Allah has taken himself a son. Holy is he? Nay. They are against the Godhead and that the scriptures teach that Jesus was forever and will be God. John chapter 1, verses 1 through 2. In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. However, the Quran says one is an unbeliever who confessed Jesus as God. Now, what does the Quran say you do with an unbeliever? You slay them. And yet the Quran says one is an unbeliever who confesses Jesus as God. One is an unbeliever who confessed Jesus as God's Son. One is forbidden heaven who confesses Jesus as God. One deserves fire and grievous punishment who confesses Jesus as God. On taking friends, on Muslims making friends. Now, I understand, once again, that some of you probably have Islamic neighbors. Some of you probably have worked with Muslims and have been perfectly fine people, but once again, if they're going by the Quran, they cannot and will not be your friend. And yet they come to the country, to the United States, and say, but we're citizens just like you. While the book which they adore says, but do not take any of the people in America as your friends. O you who believe, take not the Jew and the Christian for friends. They are friends of each other, and whoso among you takes them for friends is indeed one of them. Verily Allah guides not just unjust people. O you who believe, take not your fathers and brothers for friends. If they prefer disbelief to faith, and whoso of you takes them for friends, such are wrongdoers. the Quran is against the Jews. They say that the Jews lied about the crucifixion of Christ. And the Quran states, for they're saying we did slay the Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, the messenger of Allah, whereas they slew him not. Nor did they bring about his death upon the cross, but he was made to appear to them like one crucified. The Quran presents that Jesus did not die on the cross, but only looked like it. The Quran is against Christians for denying that Jesus is a created being. And we talked about that some last night also, because that is the view of both the Seventh-day Adventist as well as of the Jehovah Witness, that Jesus is a lower created being. And yet, in Colossians chapter 1, starting in verse 15, Paul, in referencing Jesus, says, he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. They want to look at that and say, see, this says that Jesus is the first creation of God. No, it doesn't. That's not what firstborn means. The word and the term firstborn over creation means that he was the beginning spark of it. That creation was born from him. Not that Jesus is the firstborn of creation, but that he was the initiating spark of creation itself. The Quran is against Christians for belief in the deity and sonship of Jesus and rejecting Muhammad as the prophet. The Muslims will tell you that the Bible actually talks about Muhammad. In Deuteronomy chapter 18, starting in verse 18, prophecy was given, and there's a twofold prophecy that was ultimately going to be fulfilled in Jesus. It was partly fulfilled in Joshua and ultimately fulfilled in Jesus. Deuteronomy chapter 18, verses 18 and 19. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brethren, will put my words in his mouth. He shall speak to them all that I command. It shall be, whoever will hear not my words, which he speaks in my name, I'll require to him. They say, that prophet that's spoken of here is Muhammad. However, in the New Testament, in Acts chapter 3 and verse 23, Peter says, Jesus is that prophet. Jesus was the one under consideration here, not Muhammad then. The Islamic doctrine of marriage. Now, Muhammad could violate his own law. He had 12 wives. But the Quran does teach you may marry up to 4 wives. Somebody says, but I've seen all... You know, back in the 50s and 60s, we actually romanticized the Muslim world. Think of how many movies, I Dream of Jeannie, and how many series that there were that had something Sinbad, Tales of the Arabian Nights, and so on, that we somewhat romanticized the Muslim and Islamic world. And in those, you always saw about the harem. Somebody says, but the Quran only allows 4 wives. You can't have a harem. Oh, yes. Because you could marry all the slave girls you wanted. Now, Muhammad had 9 wives at a time. That there were others upon death. Total of 12. The Quran teaches a thrice divorced woman may only be taken back if she has married someone else and been divorced from him. Within Islam, because it is such a hard codified religion, that there are many loopholes that they have throughout it though. There's a practice called muta, which is a one night marriage. That you see an attractive lady and you say, I want to have muta. I want to marry you for tonight. And then afterwards, shoo. And that's acceptable because it was a marriage. And there's no limitation that is placed upon that. It is practiced openly and commonly among the Shias. Among the Sunnis, it's considered, they practiced it one time and set it aside. However, it still continues to be practiced without doing so openly among even them. When it comes to morals and ethics, games of chance are prohibited, as gambling. Eating of pork and blood, consumption of alcohol is prohibited. Lying and adultery, especially as defined in the Quran. Because once again, these loopholes that are placed there. Because adultery is actually quite common in the Muslim world. But it has its own definitions in it. Killing is prohibited in the Quran as long as it means killing a fellow believers. That's why, although you would have only 10% of the Islamic world being jihadis. Let's see, 10% of 1.5 billion. That's still about the biggest army I know of in the world. But while that is still seems to be a rather large number, killing is prohibited so that 90% of the Muslims who are not the jihadists, you'll notice the majority will never speak out against it though. Because the Quran says that they cannot do anything to kill their fellow believers. And if I turn them over to you, I've helped to kill them. If I rat them out, if I tell you where the terrorists are, then I've helped in the killing of them. And the Quran tells me not to kill the fellow believers. Stealing is prohibited. Many of these are some moral elements that you and I would be in agreement on. The games of chance, stealing, lying, and adultery. And remember, since they are a theocratic society, believing that government is to enforce religion, when the Muslim world looks at the American world, their assumption is that we also are a theocratic country because they are, and that's all they know. So when they look in America and they see adultery and lying and drinking, and that these things are so commonplace, their assumption is, well, this is what Christians allow. And so they have this very limited exposure to Christianity, since churches cannot practice openly in those nations. And they assume that Christianity allows and permits this kind of illicit behavior. Well, time escapes us. We've had to hit the deck running to be able to cover this much. How do we deal with Islamic threat? Well, the same way we do with any threat of the devil. We expose it. We study with them. We're on guard for it. We talk to them about the devices of the devil. We encourage them to study. We invite them to worship services. And we teach them the Bible. Where did Paul begin with the pagans of his day? Where did Paul begin with the Jews? He went to the Old Testament. The Muslims are going to have much more commonality with the Old Testament. Where do we take them in studying with them? We take them to the Old Testament. We study with them from the law. Show them that Jesus is the fulfillment of it. That Jesus, Hebrews 1, 1 and 2, is the last, final, and greatest prophet. But much more than a prophet. Since the Muslims believe that someone called the Mahdi is coming back, that is, he is this ruler who's going to come back and purge the world of sin. But interestingly, the Muslims believe that the Mahdi is going to come back to usher Jesus back to the world. Then there's another commonality to study with them. That if Muhammad is greater than Jesus, why is it that the Mahdi is coming to clear the way for Jesus rather than for Muhammad? And so we too believe in the Lord's return. Take the tips from Paul in dealing with those cultures that had not that same understanding of the New Testament. Look throughout the book of Acts at how the pagans were reached, the Jews were reached, some of whose views were diametrically opposed to Christianity in that day too. We're fortunate to live in a country currently in which we can meet openly and pray openly and worship openly. And many in the world, if you were to ask them, if Christianity became illegal, if Muslims or communists or atheists took over the world and said, if you're a Christian, line up against the wall and we'll shoot you, would you stand up for God? And a lot of people in the world would say, oh yeah, I'd stand up for God. I'd worship if it were against the law. And yet they're not worshiping today when it is legal, when it is permissible. Though we're talking about some dangers and concerns that we have, what we need to do is be able to preempt that by conversion of friends, securing ourselves in the Lord, being strong in His might. We preempt it and then perhaps ward it off in the process. Can we help you this evening respond to the invitation, realizing that Jesus is the last great and final prophet? God, who at sundry times and divers manners spake in times past to the to the prophets, hath in his last days spoken in his Son. God spoke to the prophets, Hebrews 1:1, but he spoke in the person of his Son. That is, Jesus himself is the embodiment of God's message. Let's walk in his steps. And his steps led to baptism. His steps led to the field of service. His steps also led to the tomb, only to be led to the throne of God on high. Now, if we walk in his steps, we can follow in those areas too. Can we help you receive and respond to the invitation? If so, give us that privilege. You'll come now as we stand together at this time as we sing.